nobody would wake up in the morning and say, I want to believe the earth is flat. People don't choose it. So one thing is that it is about understanding that people are led to it. Much of it is about the environment they were injected to, and it wasn't a desire.
So Dan, it has been 5 years since our last conversation on behalf of the U.S. Navy's Leadership and Ethics Center, where your work was held up as something crucial for leaders to understand about dealing with people. Since then, particularly in 2020, what has happened for you as a public figure and professor and intellectual?
Yeah, so 2020 started in an incredible way. And, you know, of course, this was the beginning of COVID. And in many ways, in the first few months of COVID, I felt I was at the height of my academic career. I got an extra phone, and I was there with two phones and my laptop, and I was just answering calls just about COVID, nothing else. Very early in the morning to very late at night, and about lots of topics. How do we get people to wear masks? How do we get people not to overstock? What do we do with distant education? What do we do with domestic violence? Releasing prisoners? Like, you know, the number of questions were incredible. Do we give people fines? Big fines? Small fines? Anyway, I just felt I was really being useful. And fast forward to July, still feeling useful. But I get an email that somebody says, Dan, what happened to you? How have you changed this much? And I said, what do you mean? And I get an email back with a long, long list of links. I'll just describe one. In that link, it's described how I was injured in 70. I was burned in 70% of my body, and I spent 3 years in hospital. True. And then it goes on to describe how, because of that, I started hating healthy people. And this is why I joined the cabal, Bill Gates, the Illuminati, to try and kill as many healthy people as possible with the plandemic, both the virus and the vaccine. And the other videos have different versions. Not all of them were. The mechanism was different. The cause was different. But I was a tremendously evil person in all of those versions. And my first instinct was to just correct the impression. But I had the wisdom to ask for advice. I reached out to a couple of people in PR, and they say, don't touch it. Don't talk to them. And I said I had the wisdom to seek advice. I didn't have the wisdom to follow that advice. Mm. So I did call some people. I invited some people to meet me. I went on Telegram groups and online discussions and all kinds of things. And I failed miserably. And, you know, and plus it was very painful. But we've all read and we hear about people who adopt very different narratives. And it's one thing when it's abstract. But imagine you meet somebody and they believe something about you. And not only do they believe something about you, you have evidence that this is not the case. And you show them the evidence, and they just ignore it. That was like, you don't know much about me. I know a lot about me. Here's an evidence, including I opened my calendar. I showed them all kinds of things. Anyway, that month was very tough. Lots of attacks. By the way, I got death threats for almost 2 years straight. The frequency has gone down. The last one I got was like a week ago, but it's now less frequent. And then I realized I can't do it, what I should have realized early. And I basically decided to study this. So I basically retreated, and I said, I need to understand this. This idea that somebody is saying things about me and I can't convince them that that's not the case, there's something really terrible going on here. I need to understand this. And then I spent the next 2 years, in some of the darkest corners of the internet, in talking to multiple people and trying to understand this machinery. that takes people and change them. And to think about that in a more personal way, think about 5 years ago, and think about whether there was somebody in your life 5 years ago that at that point you thought that they see the world exactly as you do. And if there was a person who was this like this 5 years ago, and now you look at them and you say, I have a hard time believing we're the same species. I have a hard time believing that we're looking at the same information and coming to such vastly different conclusions. And there's good news and bad news. And the good news is that the funnel of misbelief explains how they are the same people and the same species. What got them to be this different? What is the mechanism? The bad news is, first of all, that we ourselves are not immune to that. We could have gone down the path of misbelief as well. But the second bad news is that this mechanism, this machinery, is so effective. It's so effective that as a society, we're really suffering from that. The individuals are suffering, but we're suffering in society, and we have to get our act together and start taking steps against that. Yeah. So that's the big picture.
Yeah. Dan, I'm excited to break down the elements of this funnel and your ideas for the future. First, I feel compelled to ask about this experience of being so hated and what you've learned about forgiveness.
So, first of all, it's very tough. There's a concept in social science, behavioral economics called scarcity mindset. Mm-hmm. And usually people use this term when they talk about poverty. Somebody is very poor, and some of their mind is occupied with, will I be able to pay the bills? Will they evacuate me? What will happen? And cognitive capacity is diminished. It's as if they have less IQ. And I certainly felt with less IQ. So the days before I start being attacked, that I knew I was attacked, I told you multiple phones and this, and I feel like I'm operating at a high level of a cognitive capacity. Once the attack started, I was still able to function, but it felt like there was a haze there. It was, mm-hmm. felt like part of my brain was always occupied. And of course, at night, all the bad things came. I had this recurring dream where I traveled the world to look for a place without hate. Hmm. Now, your question was about forgiveness. And, I'm a social scientist in my bones. So I think about experiments, and I really believe in everything we find. Like, I internalize it. And in general, we find that the environment matters a great deal. And the story about the funnel of misbelief is a story about understanding that people who got to that situation did not choose it. Hmm. Right? Nobody would wake up in the morning and say, I want to believe the earth is flat. I want to believe that Dan Ariely is a villain. People don't choose it. So one thing is that it is about understanding that people are led to it by all kinds of things. Now, it's not that I believe that people have zero agency, right? Even within that, people can choose to be more or less offensive. They can do, but I think much of it is about the environment that they were injected to, and it wasn't a desire. The other thing, there was one night in which I understood how much they suffer. Imagine you believe in God. If you believe in God, you think that God is basically good, right? I mean, all gods are basically good. Sometimes there's a devil, but mostly it's a good God. But if you believe in a conspiracy, you believe the world is evil. But worse, you believe it's powerful and evil. You believe that the world is out there to get you in some roundabout way, controlled by very wealthy people who are trying to get you and your kids. So that the it's not a good life. Mm. And I think the combination of environment plus realizing what they do to themselves basically got me to take a very different look at this.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like for you it was developing a greater understanding for how someone else could fall into these sort of situations that allowed you to maybe release maybe your own desires or you know, antipathy.
I think it was a combination of, yes, understanding the circumstances, mm-hmm. and saying it's not this person, much of it is the circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second part was actually having empathy for them.
Mm-hmm.
Saying, yeah. You know, this is tough. Like they, you know, they went down a very destructive path. It's bad for them. It's bad for the family. It's bad for society, but very bad for them.
Yes. So when you go through this experience and you sort of, you do come to a place where you feel like you can forgive a person, but then that person continues to antagonize you, do you feel as though you need to refresh that forgiveness button, or does it carry you through?
I think there's a lot of work to do to basically improve the funnel, to improve on the funnel of misbelief. There's lots of small things, a lot of big things. And I think that before we go and demand things from regular people, there's some things we need to do at the societal level. And so in the same way that, you know, if all restaurants were buffets, like let's say if I came to you every morning with a fresh tray of donuts and croissants, I don't feel it would be right to be angry with you that you gained weight by the end of the year. And so I think that's one part of it, is that once I diagnosed the system, I said, before I go and get angry with people, there's some things we need to we need to change. But at the same time, I do struggle with this. So, you know, last week was the Day of Atonement. I'm Jewish, and the Day of Atonement is a day of fast in which we reflect on life. And I chose to reflect on this question of what do we think about the nature of humanity, good or bad? Ancient decision, ancient choice, lots of debates, are people inherently good or inherently bad? And I always believe that people are inherently good, and that when people behave badly, it's either a mistake, a misconception, something about the environment, and so on. But I had a very, very strong belief that goodness is our driving force. And the last few years have put that to question. So I started thinking, you know, am I ready to update my belief? Now, I don't think I would have gone from humanity is good to humanity is 100% evil, but you know, what do I want to change some, like, my working assumption about people? And I went through lots of cases with my history and understanding and so on. And my conclusion was that there is evidence to suggest that we're less, like, you know, from 5 years ago to now, I've got lots of evidence that I should incorporate, that I can't avoid taking account of that. But I also felt that I'm not ready for it just yet. So, you know, in the, you know, child development, there's a famous psychologist called Piaget.
Yes.
And in his framework, there are stages of development. And in every stage, the kid goes outside of that stage until he can no longer mediate the path between the kid's level of development and the stage. So the kid is in a certain stage of understanding. He understands better and better, but he still holds for these beliefs. And then at some point, it breaks. And then he moves to the next stage. And I feel I'm kind of in that stage. Like, mm-hmm. my beliefs about humanity being good are less and less consistent with my experience, but I'm still forcing my beliefs on the information, and maybe one day I'll change. I'm just not ready to change just yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, your
maybe
attitude
next year.
We'll see. Your attitude about humanity is a through line through your work, looking at environment and these factors and so many things. So let's break down this funnel of misbelief, this system that brings people into things like conspiracy theories. There are several elements. There's the emotional, the cognitive, the personality, and maybe most important, the social. Let's start with the emotional. What is happening there?
Yeah, let's start with the emotional. And the emotional is really the building ground. Mm-hmm. It's the conditions. Without it, nothing bad would happen, right? So it's the starting condition. It's the starting condition. And it's basically stress. And when we think about stress, there are two types of stress. There's the kind of stress that says, oh, look at me, I'm so busy, my calendar is full. And there's a kind of stress that says, I don't understand the world. Why am I being punished? Why is this not working out? Kind of Job from the Bible, if you want. Like, you know, things are happening and like, why? Why me? Why is this happening to my health, my kids, my da-da-da? And the stress that we're talking about is not the stress of being too busy. It's the unpredictable stress. It's the Job kind of stress. And why is that so important? Because that kind of stress creates pressure on us to find the story. You know, when we think about misbelief or conspiracies, we need to understand that they are not for nothing. They serve a purpose. They answer a need. Maybe it's not the answer that we would want, but they answer a need. And the same way, by the way, we don't want to discount the people that adopt them. They're not less intelligent or smart or anything like that, but there, something creates that makes a need. So two stories about this initial part. Imagine fishermen tribes. One is fishing in the ocean, one is fishing in a lake. Which one of them has higher randomness, like the relationship between effort and whether they fish or not is going to be more random?
That's the ocean.
The deep sea, yeah. Right? Weather, all kinds of things happen. Which one of them adopts more superstitions? Mm. The ones in the ocean. Mm. So we have this situation where like you have to deal with this uncertainty. And what do we do with uncertainty? We try to get control on it. I'll give you one other example. So this kind of image, is it dancing for you or is it stable?
It looks stable.
Okay, because on my reflection it looks strange. But so this is what is called white noise, right? Mm-hmm. It's just random dots, black, white, gray. And the standard question is, do you see an image? You probably don't. What do you think happens as people get more stressed? They see more images. Mm. There's even an amazing demonstration that when people go parachuting, the closer they are to jumping, the more patterns the more shapes they see. So stress creates a need to order the world, to see a pattern. That's the starting point. But not all stories are equally good. So some stories are better than others. Some stories are more effective than others. What would make a story effective? A villain. Mm. Why a villain makes a story effective? Because all of a sudden it's not our fault, right? We want somebody else to blame. Like, I feel hard done by, something is not working out, my friends remained the job, I was fired, something happened, and now I say I need to blame it on somebody else. So we don't just want stories, we want a story with villains. And then it doesn't end there. We also want complex stories. And this is kind of strange because we know that people love simple stories. Just look at all movies. Why the complexity? And it turns out that if you think about it, the people who are looking for these stories feel that they're underdogs. They feel the society is looking down at them. And if the story is complex, they can feel superior. Hmm. They can say, Brandon, you think you understand the world, but look at me. I really understand the world, right? All of a sudden, the complex story allows them a feeling of superiority. There's this really complex issue that only we understand. So, So that's the building block. That's the first thing. And by the way, if people don't have stress, they don't turn to these things, right? If you're happy and feeling loved and you have a good job and everything is fine, you don't say, let me look at an evil plot. I mean, maybe you watch a cartoon or you know, like a superhero movie, but you're not going to do one of those. So stress is important. And one other thing about stress is that the main inoculation against stress is resilience, right? If you feel loved and supported, you know, think about what happened in COVID. It was a little harder to feel loved and supported. It was harder to feel loved and supported within the family because everybody was so stressed, but we also lost a lot of other connections.
Yes.
So we have extra stress plus low resilience, very much pushing people down the funnel. So that's the first element.
Okay.
So continue to the next one.
Yeah. So we've covered the top of the funnel of misbelief is this emotional element, and then next down would be cognitive.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the reason that it's good to think of it as a funnel is because as we get deeper, it's harder to get people back.
Mm.
So, you know, if you notice one of your friends starting to develop ideas, that's a good time to talk to them. By the time they get to the social element, it's going to be very tough to get them back. So what is the cognitive element? The cognitive element basically says, how are we as information processing machines? Information out there, we consume it. What are the things that we do in strange ways? And there's kind of three basic things. I'll mention two and give more information about one. The first one is confirmation bias. There's a whole range of information out there, and we choose to look at only some of that.
Yeah.
Right? We basically choose whatever news media agrees with us. Like how many of us go and watch the opposite? The opinion of other people. So that's the first one. That's very understandable. The second one is a bigger trick. The second is motivated reasoning. And in motivated reasoning, it's not just that we choose what to view, but once we view a piece of information, we can distort it in a way that would fit us. Right? So if confirmation bias basically say, I'm not going to look at all the information, I'll only look at this. Motivated reasoning is more complex because I'm looking at this, but I'm going to find what I want to in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And the simplest way to think about it is a sporting event. You're a fan of team A, they're playing, you know, their rival team B, and the referee calls a call against your team, and you can't help but see the referee is evil, vile, blind, got bribed, something like that. It's not a question of saying you really see it in a different way. And of course, somebody from the other team will see it in a different way. So that's motivated reasoning. But the third element is about the relationship between our knowledge and our confidence in our knowledge. And one version of this is called the illusion of explanatory depth. And what is the illusion of explanatory depth? In one demonstration, I went to people and I said, do you understand how a flush toilet works? People said, of course. I said, great. On the scale, really understand it well, perfectly fine. And then I said, well, thankfully, I have all the pieces of a flush toilet here. Please assemble them. I don't need to continue, right? Nobody could assemble them, including a woman who was actually embarrassed, terribly embarrassed, because she was actually a daughter of a plumber. But after that, we say, and now how well you understand flush toilets? And people say, I don't understand it at all.
Mm.
Now, the interesting thing is that we usually think that changing people's opinions is about showing them opposing information. You believe this, I believe this, let me attack you. But in fact, when we attack people with different information, they don't listen.
Yeah.
They become defensive. They counter argue. Maybe at the end, they're even more convinced about their own belief. They don't change, and And the illusion of explanatory depth, you don't go against them. You don't say, you're wrong, here's a piece of information, read this paper. You say, help me understand your perspective. Mm. Give me the details. Mm. I'm interested in the details. And the research on this is amazing. It's true for zippers and locks, and it's true for democracy, and it's true for viruses. And we just go around the world thinking we know things. And only when we asked about the details do we understand we don't know. So, you know, like one stimuli they used was helicopter. You understand how a helicopter works? Yes. Okay, help me understand.
No.
maybe not. I understand something goes around this way, but but really understanding, that's it. Oh, now you're talking about really understanding. Now I'm also mentioning this on the cognitive part because it's a very good mechanism to help our friends and family. Hmm. So if you go to Thanksgiving dinner and there's somebody who starts believing in alternative beliefs, first of all, don't attack them. But the second thing is try to use the illusion of explanatory depth. Say, okay, you believe the world is flat. Help me understand, how does it work exactly? Are all planets flat? How does gravity work? I mean, you know, just help me understand. Isn't it the case that everybody, like so many people know, you know, help me figure this out. So that's the cognitive part. And it's really about selection of information, distortion of information, and overconfidence in information. Then the next part is personality. Mm-hmm. And first of all, it's important to note that if you have a personality that makes you more likely to go down the path of misbelief, it doesn't mean that you will necessarily go down that path. It's mm-hmm. not like, oh, I have this personality, I'm going down. Or it's also not that, oh, I don't have this personality, I'm certainly not going down. No. It's not, it doesn't guarantee anything. It just makes it more likely. Basically, think about it, it's like a lubricant. If you have this some personality, it's more likely to have less, you're less likely. It's also not the case that the personalities are necessarily good or bad. It's about the way we process information and think about it and so on. And the way to think about what kind of personality makes it more and less likely to go down the funnel of misbelief is to go back to our original starting point, which is to say there's stress, there's need to find a story, and the question is, what changes stress? What changes acceptance of story? Like what are the things that would moderate whether this is going to be very powerful or not? So the first thing to think about is whether we trust our own intuitions. Lots of ways to think about it, but one way to think about it is to think about the problem called the bat and the ball. Of course, I know you know the problem, but I'll repeat it anyway. So here's a simple math problem. A baseball bat and a baseball ball cost together $1.10. A baseball bat and a baseball ball cost together $1.10. And the bat cost $1 more than the ball. The bat cost $1 more than the ball. And the question is, how much does the ball cost? Now, think to yourself, everybody, your answer, don't say it. Now, when people do this exercise, almost everybody has the answer 10 pops in their mind. Like the number 10 just appears too many times, it just makes sense, and people come up with it. And some people say 10 cents. And some people say, let me check myself. I say, well, if the ball was 10 cents and the bat is $1 more than the ball, the bat will be $1.10. 10 cents and $1.10, and together that's $1.20. But Dan said that together they need to be $1.10. If a 10 cent gap, it means that the ball has to be 5 cents less, the bat has to be 5 cents less, so what? Maybe it's 5 cents and $1.05. Yeah, the bat is $1 more than the ball, together they're $1.10, makes sense. Now, this is a math exercise that everybody can do,
yeah.
Like after third grade, right? There's a fourth grade. But anyway, it's very simple. not a question of intelligence, but it's a question of whether we test ourselves. And it turns out that the people who jump to conclusions about from their intuitions are more likely to go down the funnel of misbelief. So we did it with a bat and a ball, but imagine it's not the bat and the ball. Imagine it's a story about the Illuminati. And you say to yourself, oh, feels right. And some people say, I'm accepting it because it feels right. And some people say, let me test that. Let me check it with some other things. So that's the first thing. We have a pressure to find a story. We find a story, but do we adopt it because it feels right, or do we check it a little bit more? So that's one type of personality that makes a difference. Another type of personality that makes a difference is personality that connects dots that were not there, that create a different image from what was the actual image that we experienced. And to think a little bit about that, I want to tell you about my favorite conspiracy theory, which is the alien abductees. So you probably know that there are people who think that they were abducted by aliens. And the question is, how does it come about? Why? And the story is really beautiful.
Yes, this is one of my favorite parts from the book too, was reading this and sharing this with friends. I'm excited to share the story.
Because it is so beautiful, because you say, oh, there's a reason. Like, mm-hmm. it's not that people just make it up, there's a reason. So, by the way, the research that Susan Clancy that came up with it, I think she's just brilliant. It's just mm-hmm. such a, like, what a creative mind to come up with this. So there's something called sleep paralysis. What is sleep paralysis? When we sleep, especially when we have dreams, REM sleep, our brain gives our body instructions. Slay the dragon, jump over the this, save the princess, you know, you name it, depending on your dream. But we don't do it, right? The brain thinks it's awake and we are transmitting ideas, but the body doesn't act. How come? Well, it turns out the brain paralyzes our spinal cord. So the instructions are being sent, but they can't pass a certain level. So that's called sleep paralysis. Now, some people, it seems the best statistics I could see, seems like around 8% of the people, sometimes wake up still paralyzed. So imagine you have a dream, whatever the dream is, and your body is paralyzed and you wake up. And the feeling is very strange. You still have a little bit leftovers of the dream. You're paralyzed. You can't move. Now, that happens to about 8% of the population. Not every night, but from time to time. Now, not 8% of the people that in the population believe that they were abducted by aliens. So it's not the case that sleep paralysis equals belief in being an alien abductee. What else needs to happen that some people say, I had a really strange sleep with this paralysis, and some people say I was abducted by aliens? What separates those people? And one of the things that separates them is basically adding things to the picture. And they showed it in terms of memory and so on, but the idea is that you're in a sleep, there's kind of all kinds of leftovers. You can't really tell reality from the dream. Things are moving out and in and out. There's a paralysis. Now, if you basically can say, oh, I saw this and this and this, and I was paralyzed, therefore I was abducted by aliens, now you can see how completing the story, adding things that were not there but could have been there. Like you could say, I saw the alien. You know, maybe you saw a little tingling of light or something, but you add things to the picture that you think could have been there. Mm-hmm. And by the way, you can think how this ability to do this would be really good for artists.
Yeah.
And maybe even for innovators, right? Yeah. You get to imagine all kinds of things. But it also gets people to feel that they were abducted by aliens if they have sleep paralysis.
Yeah. And then, Dan, to clarify, could you share how that is tested for with the word lists?
Yeah. So there's a couple of tests, but one of the important ones is about memory. So imagine I read to you a list of 12 fruit, melon, apricot, and so on. And then I read to you some fruits that were never there. If you think that you also heard those fruits, there's some confusion there. Right? Mm-hmm. You basically expand the pictures to include things that it didn't expand. You add more details. You're more confusing things that were in the list or not the list. You add things that were not there to think that they were. They were. If something fits, you feel it was there. Like it's not your memories telling you. Say it seems that it was in this picture, in this image, in this experience. So this is connected to creativity. It's connected to augmented memory, all kinds of things like that. And then the third category of things on the personality side are basically think about narcissism. Mm. Now, the moment you say narcissism, you say, oh, you know, let me think about somebody who's extreme narcissist. We're not talking about extreme narcissists. Right? We're talking about people who are slightly more narcissist than others. So, you know, all of us have friends who are slightly less narcissist and some that are slightly more narcissist. We're not talking about the spectrum of people who are very extreme. Now, why would a narcissist go down the funnel of misbelief faster? What is it? And it goes back to stress. Because if you're a narcissist, one of the defining features is that you thrive on the world telling you how wonderful you are. That's the definition, right? You really want the world to keep on telling you how wonderful you are. And when the world stops telling you how wonderful you are, you feel with extra intensity stress. Right. So if you're not a narcissist, you can feel stressed. But if you're having the same thing with the lost job loss and spouse and so on, and now you have all of those, plus you feel it in a more intense way because you crave on this positive reinforcement. And now you have this extra stress that comes from you because you're a person that the stress is influencing to a higher degree. You not doing well is extra painful. Now, it's worthwhile saying something about stress here is that stress accumulates across domains. Mm. So you can say, well, I have stress from work and stress from my kid and stress and stress and stress. Some level, the mind doesn't separate all of these. They all accumulate. For example, there's this study across almost 70 countries that shows that as the level of violence goes up, so does the belief in COVID-19 conspiracies. So what's the relationship? More violence in a country, more conspiracies? Yes. More violence creates more stress. Not connected to COVID-19 at all. This is very different. It's not COVID-19 violence. It's just violence in the country, conflicts and so on. But now that you have a higher level of stress, the body, the mind doesn't separate. It come from here or come from there. It creates the pressure to do that. And by the way, one thing I thought about asking you, and it could be a sensitive question, is, you know, people who are in the armed forces experience, by definition, more stress.
Yes, certainly of certain forms. Yeah.
Yeah, and nobody has done that study, but. I wonder whether the propensity of adopting false narratives is stronger. So I don't think there's data on that, but I'm wondering about what are your thoughts about this?
Yes, I was wondering the same thing as I read your book, because you know I do notice these discussions, perhaps more so among my friends who are related with the military in some fashion. Although a lot of my friends are. So maybe it's hard to say. I don't have firm data, but that relationship between stress and then starting to wonder if there's, a bigger force or somebody or something, some sort of villain, that was a theme that I heard a lot. And in an organization that is so big and bureaucratic, I think it's easy to start feeling that way. You wrote a little bit about bureaucracy and how this all plays in, and I. it really did touch on a lot of my memories of being in the military. If maybe you could explain a little more about bureaucracy too.
bureaucracy pains me. So, you know, there's lots of things about procedures, right? Mm. The armed services, of course, are experts in procedures. Like if you want somebody to do something in an automated way, they practice. There's a lot of benefits, right? You would not get somebody to fight in a war without a lot of practices and making it routinized to a certain degree. So mm-hmm. there are lots of things to say in favor of routines and structures and practicing and so on. The problem with bureaucracy, though, is that it communicates lack of trust. Mm. So if I tell you, oh, you can go out for lunch and invite a friend, like a supplier or something, but I need 16 receipts and I want you to document the lunch. now it basically says, I don't trust you. And it also says, I don't respect your time because I'm asking you to document every little thing and so on. And maybe the lunch was half an hour and filling the form is another half an hour. But there's another thing, which is to say, and I don't want you to do anything differently. Hmm. So many organizations thrive on improvement. Improvement basically say, like, we can change. But if you establish very high bureaucracy, you basically are giving people a lot of disincentive to try anything differently. Hmm. Right? Because doing things the regular way, easy. Anything different, go ahead and start fighting all the elements. Incredibly tough. And then there's another element of bureaucracy that I think communicates as like a hidden agenda. Right. So think about physicians, and think about the amount of time that they spend documenting things. Here are people who came to save people and they end up doing paperwork. Then you have they think that medication A is the right medication for the patient, and down the line it's rejected, right? And it's not that they're not able to prescribe it, but there's another decision mechanism that says rejected, give something else. What is the effect on their motivation? Hmm. Yeah, what is their effect on understanding why this was happening? Who is this entity that we're dealing with? And is this entity truly interested in the well-being of the patient if they do this? There's another thing about the armed forces is that people have a mindset of thinking about an enemy.
Mm, yes.
Right. So it's not just the extra stress. There's also when I think about misbelief, taking a step back for a second, but when I think about the concept of misbelief, for me it's broken into two. There's the belief about the thing in the world that is inaccurate, not what the experts think, not what the majority thinks, right? It's about what's happening in the world. But it's also about the fact that this belief is a central tendency in my life. So it's not just something, is Android or Apple better? it's fine, I have an opinion, but I don't care enough. And if I hold the wrong opinion, it's, But if I have a belief that is I'm incredibly sure about and it's central to my life, and I view everything from that perspective, now we're talking about misbelief. Mm. So it's not just the belief in the world. Like, let's say somebody believed the Earth is flat. Somebody says, I think there's like 1% chance that the Earth is flat. Fine. It's not going to be a central theme for them. But if somebody believes the Earth is flat and that it was something that NASA did in collaboration with the government and schools. Now we're talking about a very complex story with lots of people involved and lots of other meanings. Right? It's not just the world is flat. There's a lot there. And now, if you view life from this perspective, there's a lot of ramification for it.
Mm-hmm.
The other day I was on some radio show, and after that somebody wrote me, and he wrote me about some salmonella poisoning that happened in his town. And he asked me, what do I think about it? Like, how was it caused? And I said, probably somebody made a terrible mistake. And I hope they will find out who did it and how, and fix it and fix other problems, potential problems like that. He didn't like that answer. He thought about the political composition of his town, and he thought it was intentional. Now, think about somebody who adopts an intentional perspective. Somebody, and it's permeates in everything in their life. That's now we have misbelief. So if you think about an enemy a lot, you know, that's a mindset. Yeah. So I think the combination of stress and thinking about an enemy, thinking about evil forces in our lives. By the way, there's a lot, right? It's not as if you say, oh, there isn't any. No. Yeah. We know. I'm sure we don't know the extent of it, but I think people in the armed forces are facing a tougher battle against misbelief.
Mm-hmm.
I think there need to be some extra effort to help them fight this, right? If we say this is a bad journey, it's a journey into misbelief and mistrust and so on, and we don't want people to do it, and we say we need to support people so they don't go down this path, I think the armed forces are in tough conditions, and they deserve extra help.
Yeah.
Support, media literacy. I mean, there's lots of things to
And we've talked about a compounding set of factors here too, and one that certainly comes to mind is the social as well. I have a close friend who just came back from a deployment yesterday. So he's been cut off from his usual social circles for so long, and taking in so much through digital media and things. So for that sort of environment, whether it's COVID, a deployment, whatever, how does the social element play into misbelief?
Yeah. So this is the place where I think that the armed forces have some benefits. But let's first of all talk about how does the social element work, and then go back to this. So the first element is ostracism. So the kind of classic result of ostracism, the main researcher in the field described how he goes on a walk with his dog. His dog, and he sees two people playing frisbee. They toss, and the frisbee falls next to his feet. Picks it up, throws it to them, and to his surprise, they throw it back to him. And the three of them play for a bit, and all of a sudden, they stop throwing it to him, and they just throw to themselves. And he just stands there feeling rejected. And he said he had no reason to feel rejected. He doesn't know them. He didn't come to play with them. They are two friends. Why is he feeling rejected? But the fact they played with him for a while and stopped feels ostracized. So he then went ahead and did a lot of experiments with the same basic paradigm. He would invite people. And he said, oh, wait out here for a while until we get ready to do the study. And they met two people who worked for the experimenter that tossed the ball. And sometimes they tossed the ball between all three of them for 10 minutes. And sometimes they tossed it between all three of them for 5 minutes, and then they stopped throwing as the real participant. And then they open the door and they say, hey, come and do the experiment. Now the question is, what effect does it have? And it turns out it has devastating effects.
Hmm.
It affects people's optimism and well-being. It affects dishonesty. It gets people to cheat more. It gets people to be less generous. It donate less money, helpless. I mean, lots of bad things, right? Being ostracized is very tough. And this is a place where I have to admit that I made some mistakes. So in my environment, over the last few years, when people started playing with all kinds of strange beliefs, I ostracized them. Now, to my defense, I would say I told little jokes in my mind, but I'm sure they perceived them as big jokes. If I said something like, you can't possibly think that this is correct, you know, I think I'm making a joke, but they're not necessarily. So ostracism, and by the way, it's very natural, right? If you think about those friends that you have, it's very, very hard to not react to these things. But it's not helpful. So people start exploring those ideas. They're in the beginning of the funnel. And now you ostracize them. And what do? We push them. We push them to a support group. And with the internet, it's very easy to find a support group for almost anything. So one group that they describe in the book is a group where there was a guy who posted an essay about my crimes against humanity. He predicted there will be Nuremberg 2.0 trials.
This is your crimes. This is Dan Ariely's crimes against humanity.
That's right. So he describes my crime against humanity. He thinks I'm the chief consciousness architect for the plandemic, right? He gives me a very high title, kind of compares me to the Nazi propaganda, the person in charge there, Goebbels. And he says that there will be Nuremberg 2.0 trials. They will judge people for their crimes. And he's asking the question at the end of his little essay of whether I should get life in prison or public hanging. And there's about 1,000 responses. And if you look at the tone of the responses, they're absolutely loving. Not to me, but to him. They congratulate him on his insight and his writing and his thought and his commitment to the cause. Like, there's lots of hearts, there's wonderful emojis and so on. You just look at the tone and you would say these are people that are probably kind of gathering together to figure out who to give flowers to or do something. These are just kind, wonderful people. But of course, not exactly, but you know, in the same way that we say that we should not discount misbeliefs because they fulfill a need, we should also understand that the reason that they're so positive toward each other is not for nothing. Mm-hmm. There's a reason for that. They need it. They need this level of support and love and so on because they're not getting it elsewhere. So we push them away and they find a support group. And that's a very loving support group. And now comes the next part. And the next part we call shibboleth. And shibboleth is a term in Hebrew. And it comes from a story about a war between two tribes. Bloody war. At the end of the war, they settle on two sides of the river. And as they walk around, they meet people. They want to find out if those people are from their tribe or from the opposing tribe. And there's a plant called shibboleth. And I can show you the plant, and I would say, how do you pronounce this? And one tribe pronounced it shibboleth, and one tribe pronounced it sibboleth. So now by the pronunciation, you could find out if they're from our tribe or the other one. If you're from our tribe, we'll hug you and say hi. If you're the other tribe, we'll chase you away or try and kill you. So when I ask you, what is this plant? I don't really care what is this plant. I care about pronunciation. I care about identity. And we now use this term shibboleth that when we ask a question, we don't care about the answer, we care about identity. Now, with that in mind, think a little bit about the chatter online, think about political discourse, and think about how many things people are saying that they don't believe, but they're saying it to signal to other people how loyal they are to the cause. And so, and it's not right and left. You can have it on both sides, mm-hmm. right? But it's basically saying, look, if you just say something run of the mill, you're not proving yourself. So let's say I go into a group And I say something in the middle. I say, if I'm a Republican, maybe I say, oh, Trump was a great president. And then if I'm a liberal, maybe I say, you know, gender issues are very complex. Like if you say something kind of run of the mill, you know, you can't show loyalty.
Yeah.
If you want to show loyalty, you have to say something really extreme. Like you could say Trump won the election. In fact, maybe you even say he is the president.
Mm.
And if you're a liberal, maybe you say there's not such a thing as gender. It's a myth. But when people say it for the first time, they don't necessarily mean it. They basically are just saying it to signal their identity. Now, of course, once something is said multiple times and other people repeat it and so on, it can become the norm, and then we need to become more and more extreme. And if you look at our political process, for example, it's very much like that. Very much becoming more and more extreme. And I think it's like Shibboleth is leading the expression of opinions, and then things move once those things are normalized. And then there's the last part of the social structure, which is basically cognitive dissonance. So everybody knows cognitive dissonance, but still it's worthwhile repeating. So the first real story of cognitive dissonance, it's about this woman who said that on a particular date the earth will be destroyed and only the people who follow her and she will be saved. Aliens would come and save them and then the earth will be destroyed. And Festinger thought the earth is not going to be destroyed, but he wanted to know what her followers would do. And he basically thought about die-hard followers and on-defense followers. And what you could say is maybe, you know what, the die-hard followers would be the most disappointed. These are the people who sold their homes and gave all the money to charity and said goodbye to their family and so on. They would be heartbroken the next day when they wake up and the world is still around, and they would leave immediately. On the other hand, the on-defense followers, the ones that didn't really risk anything, that didn't do much, they were just maybe yes, maybe no. Maybe they'll stay. So the idea of disappointment is that the people who are most dedicated will be the more disappointed and they would leave. But Festinger thought the opposite. So he thought that because of cognitive dissonance, the people who invested the most could not admit their mistake. So the people who are on the fence said, oh, you know, we thought she was a real prophet. Turns out she's not, but okay. Sometimes people say something that is not true. But the people who've invested a lot into it can't just say, oh, I guess I was wrong. So what did Festinger predict? He predicted the next day they would become even more committed. They would say, oh, she's the one who saved the earth. And now let's really raise money and let's get more followers. Now we know even more that she's always been the true person. And of course, he was right. And what it means is that we usually think that preferences predict behaviors. And that's true. But it's also the case that behaviors change preferences. So if somebody is investing 2 years in something, their preferences are going to change. So, you know, now COVID is basically over. But what do we expect will happen to the people who invested 3 years of their lives in this life, in this idea, in their society and so on? Can they say, oh, I guess we were wrong? Very, very hard. Very, very hard. They put so much effort. They wrote so much, they fought so much, they made videos, they did lots of things. So now they basically say it's not that we're wrong, but COVID was just a small step, and the big picture is actually governments taking over people. The big picture is actually the World Health Organization taking people's liberties away. The big picture is the social reputation and so on. So Anyway, so that's the funnel of misbelief. Stress, cognitive, personality, and the thing that seals the deal is the social. And once people get to the social, very hard to escape.
Yes. And I would love to talk about ideas, solutions. But first, Dan, for people who want to know more about your work, where should they look for you online?
So the best is my website, www.danarielly.com. And Danarielly is danarielly.com.
Great. We'll put a link to that and to your newest book, Misbelief, down in the description for everybody to check out. And Dan, what do you think we can do to move through all of this?
So we touched on a few things already, right? Mm-hmm. We said that we need to try and reduce stress. Mm-hmm. And some of it seems like it's difficult, but it's not. Like, think about the way we gave people information during COVID. It was all over the place. Surfaces are dangerous or not. Wear mask, don't wear mask. Now, when we communicate this with certainty and the next day change our mind, of course people get stressed. What's real? Mm-hmm. If the communication strategy understood stress, it would say something like, we don't know if surfaces are infectious or not. Let's, for now, it looks like it's yes, but we're not sure yet, but please be careful, right? But basically prepare people for the idea that we might change, right? So we could reduce a lot of stress and confusion this way. The second thing is social resilience. We don't have a lot of it. Mm. Income inequality is making things worse, right? If you live in as income inequality increases, people don't ask neighbors for help. Of course, online frays our social fabric. So build our own social resilience and help others as well. When we see other people starting to go down that path, attack it early. Resilience on one hand, the illusion of explanatory depth on another, and there's another little version of it that I like, which is say, what would it take to change your mind? Mm. Right? And when you say, what would it take to change your mind? You're not attacking. You say, you tell me. I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just saying, help me think about that. And that's actually quite interesting to get people to say, you know what? Maybe my opinion is not as solid as I can because I can't think of anything that would change. Like, there's something strange about my beliefs. On the cognitive side, you know, this little trick, what would it take to change your mind? The illusion of explanatory depth. Can think about those. And personality, we can't change. Mm. It's not something that we can change personality, but we can get people to adopt some slight different approaches to information. And one of them is called intellectual humility. And intellectual humility is basically about being less certain in everything. Right, basically saying, I am not sure, and I'm actually fine with not knowing. Mm-hmm. Right, so, and it's tough, especially with stress. We want to know.
Yeah.
But if we can help people develop intellectual humility, that's incredibly important. By the way, if you ask me, I would say, this is one of the things that we should start teaching in schools. Mm. Right. There's of course things like, you know, media literacy. Here's some signs that if you see a post with something like this, somebody's trying to convince you. If it's an anecdote, if it's using an authority, I mean, there's other things like that. Then there are things that the social networks need to do. And there's a lot of them, but one example. When you like something, what are you really saying? Are you saying that you're endorsing it? Or are you saying it's ridiculous? You know, everything, like, it's a very impoverished language.
Yeah.
And you know, if we, and when we can't convey our intention, you know, what does it do? So we need to disambiguate those signals. Like, right now, like, I could say I'm angry with it, or, you know, whatever, the particular social network, but it's not about angry. It's about, like, imagine something is funny and wrong. or ridiculous. Mm. How are you supposed to do it? Mm. Right? What's the... We also don't separate opinions from facts. Is somebody claiming that this is a fact, or is somebody claiming that's opinion?
So
there's lots of things on the communication front that are just confusing. Of course, there's the algorithm, and there's other things that are more difficult to do. And finally, we need to do something as society. You know, this idea of political polarization is hurting all of us. Imagine that next month there would be COVID-23. How set up are we for this? Like, just imagine that it starts, it's a small version, and we just ask people, say, look, it's COVID-23 is coming. We're not sure exactly what we need, but if you have high fever and if your kids have high fever, please don't come to work and please don't send them to school. How likely will people be to comply? Like two parents waking up and saying, you know what, we're staying home today because we want to, our kids seem to have high fever, we're not sending them to school. You know, my guess is that much less cohesion, much less care about others, much less trust, and so on. So we need to figure out what are we doing about the funnel of misbelief, but we also need to figure out what do we do with trust in society. How do we restart it? And the last election had lots of strange effects on trust.
Mm-hmm.
We're just in the beginning of this new election season. We're not starting from zero. We're starting from where we were last time. Not wouldn't be my choice of where to start. So I think we need to rebuild trust. We need to also rebuild trust. So everybody has things to do. We have to do things as individuals. School have things to do. Social media companies have things to do. The government have things to do. I think within the government, I think the health-related organization, you know, when COVID started, I thought that it would take longer for a vaccine to come about. But it was clear that at some point, some medication is what's going to save us, right? Like, it will not go away by itself. And there'll be some medication. There'll be a medication for the illness. There'll be a vaccine. I didn't know what would happen. But I thought that most likely the pharma industry is going to save us. And I thought this is a good opportunity to start documenting the unsung heroes of the pharma industry. The engineers who didn't go home, the scientists that didn't go home, the people who were just unbelievably dedicated to help all of us. And people tried lots of things. Lots of things didn't work, but people tried lots of things. And it was really kind of an amazing effort. Everybody I know that worked there was like with this unbelievable sense of mission of here. The world has served us with a terrible, bad hand, and it's within our hands to try and fix it. And you know, I thought that we should do documentaries and live camera feeds and basically admire those people who worked so tirelessly. I mean, there's lots of thankless job in society. The military is one of them. But but in this case, they were not only thankless, but at the end of COVID, they are more hated than in the beginning.
Mm.
One friend told me that when she goes to dinner, she sometimes doesn't say that she works for a pharma company.
Mm.
Right? Like, how can that be?
Mm.
It's amazing what has happened to reputation. So I think for them, it's a shame they didn't take up on this opportunity of trust building.
Hmm.
But they didn't.
Hmm. Well, Dan, I want to commend you for taking this event and finding a way to bring something out of it that could help people, and making that another chapter in your career of doing this sort of thing. And to thank you for spending this time with me. I really appreciate it.
Of course. It was a pleasure. So good to see you after so much time.
Thank you.
Thanks for watching this episode. To help get more great guests on the show, Be sure to subscribe.